The Greenland norse damage their environment in at least three ways: by destroying the natural vegetation, by causing soil erosion, and by cutting turf. As soon as they arrived, they burned woodlands to clear land for pasture, then cut down some of the remaining trees for purposes such as lumber and firewood. Trees were prevented from regenerating by livestock grazing and trampling. Studies of lake sediments yield the following picture of vegetational history around the Norse farms. The Vikings' arrival was signaled by a layer of charcoal from fires to clear pastures for their livestock. Pollen of willow and birch trees decreased, while pollen of grasses, sedges, weeds, and pasture plants introduced by the Norse rose. Increased magnetic susceptibility values show that topsoil was carried into lakes, the topsoil having lost the plant cover that had previously protected it from erosion. Finally, sand underlying the topsoil also was carried in when whole valleys had been denuded of their plant cover and soil. The most obvious consequence of deforestation was that the Norse quickly became short of lumber. The low and thin trunks of the willow, birch, and juniper trees remaining were suitable for making only small household wooden objects. For large pieces of wood to fashion into beams of houses, boats, sledges, barrels, wall panels, and beds, the Norse came to depend on three sources of timber: Siberian driftwood, imported logs from Norway, and trees felled by the Greenlanders themselves on voyages to the Labrador coast. Lumber evidently remained so scarce that wooden objects were recycled rather than discarded. This can be deduced from the absence of large wooden panels and furniture at most Greenland Norse ruins. Another consequence of deforestation is poverty in firewood. Unlike the Inuit, who learned to use blubber for heating and lighting their dwellings, the Norse continued to burn willow and alder wood in their houses. A major additional demand for firewood was in the dairy. Milk quickly spoils if left to stand. Hence, the vessels in which the Norse collected and stored milk and made cheese had to be washed frequently with boiled water, twice a day in the case of milk buckets. The Norse substituted other materials for scarce firewood by burning animal bones, manure, and turf. But those solutions, too, had disadvantages. The bones and manure could otherwise have been used to fertilize fields, and burning turf was tantamount to destroying pasture. The remaining heavy consequences of deforestation involved shortages of iron. Scandinavians obtained most of their iron by extracting the metal from bog sediments with low iron content. The extraction required huge quantities of wood to make charcoal with which to produce the necessary very high temperature of fire. Even when the Greenlanders skipped that step by importing iron ingots from Norway, they still needed charcoal to work the iron into tools and to sharpen, repair, and remake iron tools. We know that the Greenlanders possessed iron tools and worked with iron. Many of the larger Norse Greenland farms have remains of iron smithies and iron slag. But those same sites make clear that the Greenlanders were desperately short of iron. A few iron nails have been found in the lowest archaeological layers there, almost none in later layers, because iron became too precious to discard. Not a single sword, helmet, or even a piece of one has been found in Greenland. Iron tools were reused and resharpened until worn down to stubs. The Greenlanders' iron poverty is also clear from the many objects recovered at their archaeological sites that were routinely made of iron, but that the Greenlanders made of other, often unexpected, materials. Iceland's annals for the year 1189 describe with surprise how a Greenland ship that had drifted off course to Iceland was nailed not with iron nails, but with wooden pegs, and then lashed together with whale baleen. A result of the Greenlanders' iron poverty was reduced efficiency of their economy. With few iron scythes, cleavers, and shears available, it would have taken more time to harvest hay, butcher a carcass, and shear sheep. But a more immediately fatal consequence was that the Norse lost their military advantage over the Inuit. Elsewhere around the world, in innumerable battles between European colonizers and the native peoples whom they encountered, steel swords and armor gave Europeans enormous advantages. But there is no evidence that the Greenland Norse, after the first few generations, had steel weapons or steel armor anymore. Instead, they fought with bows, arrows, and lances, just as did the Inuit. Nor is there any evidence that the Greenland Norse used their horses in battle as cavalry steeds. The Greenland Norse also lacked professional military training. They thereby ended up with no military advantage whatsoever over the Inuit, with probable consequences for their fate. Thus, the impact of the Norse on the natural vegetation left them short of lumber, fuel, and iron. Their other two main types of impact on soil and on turf left them short of useful land. We saw how the fragility of Iceland's light volcanic soils opened the door there to big problems of soil erosion. While Greenland's soils are not as supersensitive as Iceland's, they still rank as relatively fragile by world standards, because Greenland's short, cool growing season results in slow rates of plant growth, slow soil formation, and thin topsoil layers. Slow plant growth also translates into low soil content of organic humus and clay, soil constituents that serve to keep the soil moist. Hence, Greenland's soils are easily dried out by the frequent strong winds. The sequence of soil erosion in Greenland begins with cutting or burning the cover of trees and shrubs. With the trees and shrubs gone, livestock grazes down the grass. Once the grass cover is broken and the soil is exposed, soil is carried away by the strong winds and heavy rains, to the point where the topsoil can be removed for a distance of miles from an entire valley. In areas where sand becomes exposed, it is picked up by the wind and dumped downwind. Some abandoned Norse farms are covered by sand 10 feet deep. The other means by which the Norse inadvertently made land useless was that they cut turf for buildings and to burn as fuel. Almost all buildings were constructed mostly of turf, with at best only a stone foundation plus some wooden beams to support the roof. Greenland turf walls tended to be thick, up to 6 feet thick, in order to provide insulation against the cold. A large Greenland residential house is estimated to have consumed about 10 acres of turf. That amount was not needed just once, because turf gradually disintegrates, so that a building must be re-turfed every few decades. The slow regeneration of turf in Greenland meant that that damage was long-lasting. The Inuit play a major role in the story of the demise of Viking Greenland. At minimum, they represent a missed opportunity. The Greenland Vikings would have had a better chance of surviving if they had learned from or traded with the Inuit. At maximum, Inuit attacks on or threats to the Vikings may have played a direct role in the Vikings' extinction. The Inuit are also significant in proving to us that persistence of human societies wasn't impossible in medieval Greenland. Why did the Vikings eventually fail where the Inuit succeeded? Inuit culture and technology, including mastery of whale hunting and open waters, arose in the Bering Strait region somewhat before AD 1000. Dog sleds on land and large boats at sea enabled the Inuit to travel and transport supplies. As the Arctic became warmer in the Middle Ages and the frozen waterways separating Canadian Arctic islands thawed, the Inuit followed their bowhead whale prey through those waterways eastwards across Canada, entering northwest Greenland by 1200, and thereafter moving south along Greenland's west coast to reach the Nordsetta, then the vicinity of western settlement around 1300, and the vicinity of eastern settlement around 1400. The hunting of whales gave them an additional major food supply unavailable to the Norse. Hence, Inuit hunters could feed lots of wives and children and lived in large settlements, typically housing dozens of people, including 10 or 20 adult male hunters and fighters. In the prime hunting grounds of the Nordsetta, the Inuit established a huge settlement that gradually accumulated hundreds of dwellings. Just imagine the problems it must have created if a group of Norse hunters, who could hardly have numbered more than a few dozen, were detected by such a big group of Inuit and failed to establish good relations. Unlike the Norse, the Inuit represented the climax of thousands of years of learning to master Arctic conditions. So, Greenland has little wood? That was no problem for the Inuit. They built igloos for winter travel out of snow, and they burned whale and seal blubber both for fuel and for lighting lamps. They stretched seal skins over frameworks to build kayaks, as well as boats called umiaks, big enough to take out into unprotected waters for hunting whales. Despite having read about what exquisite watercraft Inuit kayaks were, I was still astonished when I first saw a traditional Inuit kayak in Greenland. 19 feet long, much longer than I had ever imagined, the deck of the slim kayak was packed with weaponry. A harpoon shaft with a spear thrower extension at the grip end, a separate harpoon head about 6 inches long, attachable to the shaft by a toggle connection, a dart to throw at birds, several sealskin bladders to act as drags on harpooned whales or seals, and a lance for delivering the death blow to the harpooned animal. Unlike any other watercraft known to me, the kayak was individually tailored to its paddler's size, weight, and arm strength. It was actually worn by its owner, and its seat was a sewn garment joined to the owner's parka and guaranteeing a waterproof seal so that ice-cold water splashing over the decks could not wet him. In their range of hunting strategies, the Inuit were the most flexible and sophisticated hunters in Arctic history. Besides killing caribou, walruses, and land birds in ways not unlike those of the Norse, the Inuit used their fast kayaks to harpoon seals and to run down seabirds on the ocean, and used umiaks and harpoons to kill whales in open waters. The Inuit also devised a specialized technique for hunting ring seal, the most abundant seal species in Greenland waters. Unlike other Greenland seal species, the ringed seal winters off the coast under the ice by opening breathing holes through the ice just large enough for its head. The holes are difficult to spot because the seal leaves them covered with a cone of snow. A hunter could not knock the snow cone off the hole, else the seal would realize that someone was waiting for it. Hence the hunter stood patiently next to a cone in the darkness of the Arctic winter, waited motionless for as many hours as necessary to hear a seal arrive to catch a quick breath, and then tried to harpoon the animal through the snow cone without being able to see it. As the impaled seal swam off, the harpoon head detached from the shaft, but remained attached to a rope, which the hunter played out and pulled until the seal became exhausted and could be dragged in and lanced. That whole operation is difficult to learn and execute successfully. The Norse never did. What about relations between the Inuit and the Norse? Incredibly, during the centuries that those two peoples shared Greenland, Norse annals include only two or three brief references to the Inuit. A history of Norway, preserved in a 15th century manuscript, explains how the Norse first encountered Greenland natives. Farther to the north, beyond the Norse settlements, hunters have come across small people, whom they call skrylings. When they are stabbed with a non-fatal wound, their wounds turn white and they don't bleed. But when they are mortally wounded, they bleed incessantly. They have no iron, but they use walrus tusks as missiles and sharp stones as tools. Brief as this account is, it suggests that the Norse had a bad attitude. Skrylings translates approximately as wretches. It bodes poorly for peaceful relations if you take the first person whom you see and you try stabbing him as an experiment to figure out how much he bleeds. The second of the three mentions is equally brief and imputes to the Skrylings a role in destroying the Western settlement in 1360. The remaining mention is a single sentence in Iceland's annals for the year 1379. The Skrylings assaulted the Greenlanders, killing 18 men, and captured 2 boys and 1 bondswoman and made them slaves. This incident would presumably have taken place near Eastern Settlement, because Western Settlement no longer existed, and a Norse hunting party would have been unlikely to include a woman. Those three brief texts are our sole written sources of information about Norse-Inuit relations. Archaeological sources of information consist of Norse artifacts or copies of Norse artifacts found at Inuit sites. For most of the objects, it is impossible for us to know whether the Inuit acquired them from the Norse themselves by trade, by killing or robbing Norse, or by scavenging Norse settlements after the Norse had abandoned them. However, 10 pieces of metal come from bells of Eastern settlement churches, presumably obtained by the Inuit after the demise of the Norse. Firmer evidence of face-to-face contact between the two peoples comes from 9 Inuit carvings of human figures that are unmistakably Norse. The Inuit also learned some useful technologies from the Norse. While Inuit tools in the shape of a European knife or saw could just have been copied from plundered Norse objects without any friendly contact with a live Norseman, Inuit-made barrel staves and screw-threaded arrowheads suggest that the Inuit actually saw Norse men making or using barrels and screws. On the other hand, corresponding evidence of Inuit objects at Norse sites is almost non-existent. 1 Inuit antler comb, 2 bird darts, 1 ivory towline handle, and 1 piece of meteoric iron. Those are the grand total known to me for all of Norse Greenland. Astounding by their complete absence are all the useful pieces of Inuit technology that the Norse could have copied with profit, but didn't. There is not a single harpoon, spear thrower, or kayak piece from any Norse site. If trade did develop between the Inuit and Norse, it would probably have involved walrus ivory, which the Inuit were skilled at hunting, and which the Norse sought as their most valuable export to Europe. Unfortunately, there is no way to determine whether the pieces of ivory found on many Norse farms came from walruses killed by the Norse themselves or by the Inuit. But we certainly don't find at Norse sites the bones of what I think would have been the most precious things that the Inuit could have traded to the Norse. Ringed seals, hunted successfully by the Inuit but not by the Norse, and available at a time of year when the Norse were chronically at risk of starving. That suggests to me that there really was very little, if any, trade between the two peoples. Nor do we have any skeletal or genetic evidence of Inuit-Norse intermarriage. Careful study of the skulls of skeletons buried in Greenland Norse churchyards failed to detect any Inuit-Norse hybrid. Both the failure to develop trade with the Inuit and the failure to learn from them represented, from our perspective, huge losses to the Norse, although they evidently didn't see it that way. Why didn't trade develop? One answer is the cultural obstacles to intermarriage, or just to learning, between the Norse and the Inuit. An Inuit wife would not have been nearly as useful to a Norseman as was a Norse wife. What a Norseman wanted from a wife was the ability to weave and spin wool, to tend and milk cattle and sheep, and to make skyr and butter and cheese, which Norse, but not Inuit, girls learned from childhood. Even if a Norse hunter did befriend an Inuit hunter, the Norseman couldn't just borrow his friend's kayak and learn how to use it, because the kayak was, in effect, a very complicated and individually tailored piece of clothing connected to a boat, made to fit that particular Inuit hunter, and fabricated by the Inuit's wife, who, unlike Norse girls, had learned from childhood to sew skins. Hence, a Norse hunter who had seen an Inuit kayak couldn't just come home and tell his wife to sew me one of those things. If you hope to persuade an Inuit woman to make you a kayak, or to let you marry her daughter, you have to establish a friendly relationship in the first place. But we have seen that the Norse had a bad attitude, referring to the Inuit as wretches, and killing the first natives they encountered. The end of the Greenland Norse colony is often described as a mystery. That's true, but only partly so. Only the proximate reasons remain partly mysterious. The ultimate reasons are clear. They consist of the five sets of factors that we have already discussed in detail. Norse impact on the environment, climate change, decline in friendly contact with Norway, increase in hostile contact with the Inuit, and the conservative outlook of the Norse. Briefly, the Norse inadvertently depleted the environmental resources in which they depended, by cutting trees, stripping turf, overgrazing, and causing soil erosion. That depletion threatened the society's survival in poor years. Second, calculations of climate from Greenland ice cores show that it was relatively mild when the Norse arrived, went through several runs of cold years in the 1300s, and then plunged in the early 1400s into the Little Ice Age. That lowered hay production, as well as clogging the ship lanes between Greenland and Norway with sea ice. Third, those obstacles to shipping were only one reason for the decline and eventual end of trade with Norway, on which the Greenlanders depended for their iron, some timber, and their cultural identity. About half of Norway's population died when the Black Death struck in 1349. Norway, Sweden, and Denmark became joined in 1397 under one king, who proceeded to neglect Norway as the poorest of his three provinces. The demand for walrus ivory declined when the Crusades gave Europe access again to elephant ivory. By the 1400s, carving with ivory of any sort was out of fashion in Europe. All those changes undermined Norway's resources and motivation for sending ships to Greenland. Finally, the arrival of the Inuit and the inability or unwillingness of the Norse to make drastic changes completed the quintet of ultimate factors behind the Greenland colony's demise. Of the two Norse settlements, the first to vanish completely was the smaller western settlement. It was more marginal for raising livestock than eastern settlement, because its more northerly location meant considerably less hay production, and hence greater likelihood that a cold or wet summer would result in too little hay to feed the animals through the following winter. A further cause of vulnerability was that its only access to the sea was by a single fjord, so that a hostile group of Inuit at the mouth of that one fjord could cut off all access to the crucial seal migration along the coast, on which the Norse depended for food in the late spring. We have two sources of information about the end of Western settlement, written and archaeological. The written account is by a priest named Ivar Bardason, who was sent to Greenland from Norway to act as ombudsman and royal tax collector, and to report on the condition of the church in Greenland. Sometime after his return to Norway around 1362, Bardason wrote an account called Description of Greenland, of which the original text is lost, and which we know only through later copies. Most of the preserved description consists of lists of Greenland churches and properties, buried among which is an exasperatingly brief account of the end of Western settlement. In the Western settlement stands a large church named Stenna's Church. That church was for a time the cathedral and bishop's seat. Now the Skrylings have the entire Western settlement. All the foregoing was told us by Ivar Bardason Greenlander, that he had seen all this and he was one of those appointed to go to the Western settlement in order to drive the Skrylings out. On their arrival, they found no men, either Christian or heathen. I feel like shaking Ivar Bardason's corpse in frustration. How could 1,000 people have vanished down to the last individual? Were there any signs of fighting, burned buildings, or dead bodies? But Bardason tells us nothing more. Instead, we have to turn to the findings of archaeologists who excavated the uppermost layer of debris at several Western settlement farms. In the ruins of those farms are doors, posts, roof timbers, furniture, and other big wooden objects. That's unusual. When a farm building is abandoned intentionally in northern Scandinavia, such precious wooden objects are typically carried away to reuse. Evidently, Western settlement was either abandoned hastily, or else its last occupants died there. The animal bones in those topmost layers tell a grim story. They include foot bones of small wild birds and rabbits, which would normally have been considered too small to be worth hunting and usable only as last-ditch famine food. Bones of a newborn calf and lamb, which would have been born in the late spring. The toe bones of a number of cows, approximately equal to the number of spaces in that farm's cow barn, suggesting that all cows had been slaughtered and were eaten down to the hooves. And partial skeletons of big hunting dogs with knife marks on the bones. Dog bones are otherwise virtually absent in Norse houses, because the Norse were no more willing to eat their dogs than we are today. By killing the dogs on which they depended to hunt caribou in the autumn, and by killing the newborn livestock needed to rebuild their herds, the last inhabitants were in effect saying that they were too desperately hungry to care about the future. In lower debris layers of the houses, the carrion-eating flies associated with human feces belong to warmth-loving fly species, but the top layer had only cold-tolerant fly species, suggesting that the inhabitants had run out of fuel as well as of food. All of these archaeological details tell us that the last inhabitants of those Western settlement farms starved and froze to death in the spring. One has to wonder why archaeologists did not also find the skeletons of the Norse themselves in those collapsed houses. I suspect that Ivar Bardason failed to mention that his group from Eastern Settlement performed a cleanup of Western Settlement and gave a Christian burial to the bodies of their kinsmen. As for the end of Eastern Settlement, the last Greenland voyage of the royal trading ship promised by the King of Norway was in 1368. That ship sank in the following year. Thereafter, we have records of only 4 other sailings to Greenland in 1381, 82, 85, and 1406, all by private ships whose captains alleged that their destination had really been Iceland and that they had been blown off course. When we recall that the Norwegian king asserted exclusive rights to the Greenland trade, we must consider 4 such unintentional voyages as an astonishing coincidence. Much more likely, the captain's claims were just alibis to cover their real intentions. As the captains undoubtedly knew, so few ships were visiting that the Greenlanders were desperate for trade goods, and Norwegian imports could be sold at a big profit. Thorstein Olofsson, captain of the 1406 ship, could not have been too sad at his navigational error, because he spent nearly 4 years in Greenland before returning to Norway in 1410. Captain Olofsson brought back three pieces of recent news from Greenland. First, a man named Kolgrim was burned at the stake in 1407 for having used witchcraft to seduce a woman named Steinen. Second, poor Steinen then went insane and died. Finally, Olofsson himself and a local girl named Sigrid Bjørnsdottir were married in Kvalsey Church on September 14, 1408, after the banns had been read for the happy couple on three previous Sundays and no one had objected. Those are just the usual goings-on for any medieval European Christian society and give no hint of trouble. They are our last definite written notices of Norse Greenland. We don't know exactly when Eastern settlement vanished. Between 1400 and 1420, the climate in the North Atlantic became colder and stormier, and mentions of ship traffic to Greenland ceased. It was not until 1576 to 1587 that we know definitely of further European visitors, when the English explorers Martin Frobisher and John Davis sighted and landed in Greenland, met Inuit, traded with them, and kidnapped several to bring back to exhibit in England. In 1607, a Danish-Norwegian expedition set out specifically to visit Eastern Settlement, but was deceived by the name into supposing that it lay on Greenland's east coast, and hence found no evidence of the Norse. From then on, throughout the 17th century, more Danish-Norwegian expeditions and Dutch and English whalers stopped in Greenland and kidnapped more Inuit, who were assumed to be descendants of blue-eyed, blonde-haired Vikings, despite their completely different physical appearance and language. Finally, in 1721, the Norwegian Lutheran missionary Hans Egede sailed for Greenland, in the conviction that the Inuit really were Norse Catholics, who had reverted to paganism and must by now be eager for a Christian missionary to convert them to Lutheranism. He happened first to land in the fjords of Western Settlement, where, to his surprise, he found only people who were clearly not Norse, and who showed him ruins of former Norse farms. In 1723, the Inuit showed him more extensive Norse ruins, including Kvalsey Church, at the site of what we now know to be Eastern Settlement. That forced him to admit to himself that the Norse colony really had vanished, and his search for an answer to the mystery began. He wondered whether the Norse had been exterminated by the Inuit. Ever since then, visitors and archaeologists have been trying to find out the answer. The archaeological investigations of the top layers at Western Settlement tell us something about the proximate causes of the collapse in the final year there, but we have no corresponding information about what happened in the last year of Eastern Settlement, because its top layers have not been investigated. Having taken the story this far, I can't resist fleshing out the end with some speculation. It seems to me that the collapse of Eastern Settlement must have been sudden. Greenland Norse society was a delicately balanced house of cards, whose ability to remain standing depended ultimately on the authority of the church and of the chiefs. Respect for both of those authorities would have declined when the promised ships stopped coming from Norway, and when the climate got colder. The last bishop of Greenland died around 1378, and no new bishop arrived from Norway to replace him. How could that society have continued to function when the last priest ordained by the last bishop eventually died? Similarly, the authority of a chief depended on the chief's having resources to redistribute to his followers in hard times. If the people on poor farms were starving to death while the chief survived on an adjacent richer farm, would the poor farmers have continued to obey their chief up to their last breath? One can imagine the smaller and more marginal farms of the Eastern Settlement getting starved out. But what could have happened at Garter, whose two cattle barns had space for 160 cows, and which had uncounted herds of sheep? I would guess that at the end, Garter was like an overcrowded lifeboat. Starving people would have poured into Garter, and the outnumbered chiefs and church officials could no longer prevent them from slaughtering the last cattle and sheep. Garter's supplies, which might have sufficed to keep Garter's own inhabitants alive, would have been used up in the last winter when everybody tried to climb into the lifeboat. Eastern Settlement was larger than Western Settlement, but the outcome was the same. It merely took longer. Were the Greenland Norse doomed from the outset? were they at a hopeless disadvantage compared to all the Native American hunter-gatherer peoples who had occupied Greenland on and off for thousands of years before the Norse arrived? I don't think so. Before the Inuit, there had been at least four previous waves of Native Americans from the Canadian Arctic who had died out one after another. While the Inuit have persisted in Greenland for 8 centuries, archaeologists have discovered many Inuit houses sealed up like time capsules, containing the bodies of Inuit families that starved to death during a harsh winter. Compared to the Inuit, the Norse enjoyed the big advantage of an additional food source, livestock. In that respect, the Norse potentially had a better chance of surviving, if only they had taken advantage of the wild foods that Native Americans used, but that the Norse did not. That they did not hunt the ringed seals, fish, and whales was their own decision. The Norse starved in the presence of abundant, unutilized food resources. Why did they make that decision, which from our perspective seems suicidal? Actually, from the perspective of their own observations, values, and previous experience, Norse decision-making was no more suicidal than is ours today. 4 sets of considerations stamped their outlook. First, the Norse had the fortune, or misfortune, to arrive in Greenland when its climate was relatively mild. Not having lived there for the previous 1,000 years, they had not experienced a series of cold and warm cycles, and had no way to foresee the later difficulties of maintaining livestock when Greenland's climate would go into a cold cycle. Second, the Norse did not enter Greenland with their minds a blank slate. Instead, like all colonizing peoples, they arrived with their own knowledge, cultural values, and preferred lifestyle. They thought of themselves as dairy farmers, Christians, Europeans, and specifically, Norse. Their Norwegian forebears had successfully practiced dairy farming for 3,000 years. Shared language, religion, and culture bound them to Norway. Without those shared Norwegian values, the Norse could not have cooperated to survive in Greenland. In that light, their investments in cows, the Nordsetta hunt, and churches are understandable. Even though, on purely economic grounds, those may not have been the best use of Norse energy. The Norse were undone by the same social glue that had enabled them to master Greenland's difficulties. That proves to be a common theme throughout history. The values to which people cling most stubbornly under inappropriate conditions are those values that were previously the source of their greatest triumphs over adversity. Third, the Norse, like other medieval European Christians, scorned pagan non-European peoples and lacked experience of how best to deal with them. Hence, the Norse refused to learn from the Inuit, and probably behaved towards them in ways ensuring their enmity. Finally, power in Norse Greenland was concentrated at the top, in the hands of the chiefs and clergy. They owned most of the land, including all the best farms, owned the boats, and controlled the trade with Europe. They chose to devote much of that trade to importing goods that brought prestige to them. There were many innovations that might have improved the material conditions of the Norse, but those innovations could have threatened the power, prestige, and narrow interests of the chiefs. In the tightly controlled, interdependent society of Norse Greenland, the chiefs were in a position to prevent others from trying out such innovations. Thus, Norse society's structure created a conflict between the short-term interests of those in power and the long-term interests of the society as a whole. We modern Americans should not be too quick to brand them as failures. When their society survived in Greenland for longer than our English-speaking society has survived so far in North America. Ultimately, though, the chiefs found themselves without followers. The last right that they obtained for themselves was the privilege of being the last to starve. I've described 6 past societies whose failure to solve the environmental problems that they created or encountered contributed to their eventual collapse. I dwelt on their failures because they offer us many lessons. However, it's certainly not the case that all past societies were doomed. The Icelanders have survived in a difficult environment for over 1,100 years, and many other societies have persisted for thousands of years. Those success stories also hold lessons for us, as well as hope and inspiration. They suggest that there are 2 contrasting types of approaches to solving environmental problems. This recognition stems especially from the work of archaeologist Patrick Kirch on Pacific islands of different sizes with different societal outcomes. The occupation of tiny Tikopia Island was still sustainable after 3,000 years. Medium-sized Mangaia underwent a deforestation-triggered collapse, and the largest of the three islands, Tonga, has been operating more or less sustainably for 3,200 years. Why did the small island and the large island ultimately succeed in mastering their environmental problems, while the medium-sized island failed? Small societies occupying a small island or homeland can adopt a bottom-up approach to environmental management. All its inhabitants are familiar with the entire island, know that they are affected by developments throughout the island, and share a sense of identity and common interests. Hence, everybody realizes that they will benefit from sound environmental measures that they and their neighbors adopt. That's bottom-up management, in which people work together to solve their own problems. The opposite approach is the top-down approach, suited to a large society with centralized political organization, like Polynesian Tonga. Tonga is much too large for any individual peasant farmer to be familiar with the whole archipelago. Some problem might be going on in a distant part of the archipelago that could ultimately prove fatal to the farmer's lifestyle, but of which he initially has no knowledge. Even if he did know about it, he might think that it made no difference to him. Conversely, a farmer might be inclined to gloss over problems in his own area, like deforestation, because he assumes that there are plenty of trees somewhere else. But in fact, he doesn't know. The king does have an overview over the whole archipelago, unlike local farmers. Also, the king may be motivated to attend to the long-term interests of the whole archipelago, because the king derives his wealth from the whole archipelago. He is the latest in a line of rulers, and he expects his descendants to rule Tonga forever. Thus, the king may practice top-down management of environmental resources, and may give all of his subjects orders that are good for them in the long run, but that they don't know enough to have formulated themselves. Traditional middle-sized societies, occupying medium-sized islands or homelands, may not be well-suited for either of these approaches. The island is too large for a local farmer to have an overview of or stake in all parts of the island. Hostility between chiefs and neighboring valleys prevents agreement or coordinated action. The island may be too small for a central government to have arisen, capable of controlling the entire island. That appears to have been the fate of Mangaia, and may have affected other middle-sized societies in the past. Today, when the whole world is organized into states, fewer middle-sized societies may be facing this dilemma, but it may still arise in countries where state control is weak. To illustrate these contrasting approaches to success, I shall now relate briefly the story of two small-scale societies where bottom-up approaches worked, and one large-scale society where top-down measures worked. In all three cases, the environmental problems addressed were deforestation, erosion, and soil fertility. However, many other past societies have adopted similar approaches for solving problems of water resources, fishing, and hunting. It should also be understood that bottom-up and top-down approaches can coexist. For example, in the United States and other democracies, we have bottom-up management by local neighborhood and citizens groups coexisting with top-down management by many levels of government. The first example is the Highlands of New Guinea, one of the world's great success stories of bottom-up management. People have been living self-sustainably in New Guinea for about 46,000 years. Until recent times, without economically significant inputs from societies outside the highlands. New Guinea is a large island just north of Australia, lying almost on the equator, and hence with hot tropical rainforest in the lowlands, but whose rugged interior consists of alternating ridges and valleys, culminating in glacier-covered mountains up to 16,500 feet high. The ruggedness of the terrain confined European explorers to the coast and lowland rivers for 400 years, during which it became assumed that the interior was uninhabited. It was therefore a shock when airplanes first flew over the interior in the 1930s for the pilots to see below them a landscape transformed by millions of people previously unknown to the outside world. The scene looked like the most densely populated areas of Holland, broad open valleys with few clumps of trees, divided as far as the eye could see into neatly laid out gardens, separated by ditches for irrigation and drainage, terraced steep hillsides reminiscent of Java or Japan, and villages surrounded by defensive stockades. When more Europeans followed up the pilots' discoveries overland, they found that the inhabitants were farmers who grew taro, bananas, yams, sugarcane, sweet potatoes, pigs, and chickens. We now know that the New Guinea Highlands were one of only 9 independent centers of plant domestication in the world, and that agriculture has been going on there for about 7,000 years, one of the world's longest-running experiments in sustainable food production. To European explorers and colonizers, New Guinea Highlanders seem primitive. They lived in thatched huts, were chronically at war with each other, had no kings or even chiefs, lacked writing, and wore little or no clothing, even under cold conditions with heavy rain. They lacked metal and made their tools instead of stone, wood, and bone. That primitive appearance proved deceptive, because their farming methods are sophisticated, so much so that European agronomists still don't understand today, in some cases, the reasons why New Guineans' methods work and why well-intentioned European farming innovations failed there. For instance, one European agricultural advisor was horrified to notice that a New Guinean sweet potato garden on a steep slope in a wet area had vertical drainage ditches running straight down the slope. He convinced the villagers to put in drains running horizontally along contours, according to good European practices. Awed by him, the villagers reoriented their drains, with the result that water built up behind the drains, and in the next heavy rains, a landslide carried the entire garden down the slope into the river below. That's only one of the techniques that New Guineans worked out over the course of thousands of years for growing crops in areas receiving up to 400 inches of rain per year, with frequent earthquakes, landslides, and at higher elevations, frost. To maintain soil fertility, they resorted to a whole suite of techniques, besides the silviculture that I'll explain in a moment. They added weeds, grass, old vines, and other organic matter to the soil as compost at up to 16 tons per acre. They applied garbage, ash from fires, rotten logs, and chicken manure as mulches and fertilizers to the soil surface. They dug ditches around fields to lower the water table and prevent waterlogging, and transferred the organic muck dug out of those ditches onto the soil surface. Legume food crops that fix atmospheric nitrogen, such as beans, were rotated with other crops. In effect, an independent New Guinean invention of a crop rotation principle now widespread in first world agriculture for maintaining soil nitrogen levels. Sustainable agriculture in the New Guinea Highlands poses difficult problems not only of soil fertility, but also of wood supplies as a result of forests having to be cleared for gardens and villages. Originally, the highlands were covered with oak and beech forests, but thousands of years of gardening have left the most densely populated areas completely deforested up to an elevation of 8,000 feet. Where do the highlanders obtain the wood they need? On the first day of my visit to the highlands in 1964, I saw groves of a species of a casuarina tree in villages and gardens, also known as she-oaks or ironwood. Casuarinas are a group of several dozen tree species with leaves resembling pine needles, native to Pacific Islands, Australia, Southeast Asia, and tropical East Africa, but now widely introduced elsewhere because of their easily split but very hard wood. A species native to the New Guinea Highlands, Casuarina oligodon, is the one that several million Highlanders grow on a massive scale, by transplanting seedlings that have sprouted naturally along stream banks. So extensive is the scale of transplanting that the practice is now referred to as silviculture. Casuarina oligodon is fast-growing. Its wood is excellent for timber and fuel. Its root nodules that fix nitrogen and its copious leaf fall add both nitrogen and carbon to the soil. The roots hold soil on steep slopes and thereby reduce erosion. Highlanders also say that they appreciate their casuarina groves for aesthetic reasons, because they like the sound of the wind blowing through the branches, and because the trees provide shade to the village. Thus, even in broad valleys from which the original forest has been completely cleared, silviculture permits a wood-dependent society to continue to thrive. I have presented New Guinea Highland Casuarina silviculture as an example of bottom-up problem-solving, even though there are no written records to tell us exactly how the technique was adopted. But it could hardly have been by any other type of problem-solving, because New Guinea Highland societies represent an ultra-democratic extreme of bottom-up decision-making. Until the arrival of Dutch and Australian colonial government in the 1930s, there had not been even any beginnings of political unification, merely individual villages. Within each village, instead of hereditary leaders or chiefs, there were individuals called big men, who by force of personality were more influential than other individuals, but still lived in a hut like everybody else's, and tilled a garden like anybody else's. Decisions were, and often still are today, reached by means of everybody in the village sitting down together and talking, and talking, and talking. The big men couldn't give orders, and they might or might not succeed in persuading others to adopt their proposals. That must have been the context in which casuarina silviculture and all those other useful agricultural practices were adopted in the New Guinea Highlands. People in any village could see the deforestation going on around them, could recognize the lower growth rates of their crops as gardens lost fertility, and experience the consequences of timber and fuel scarcity. New Guineans are more curious and experimental than any other people that I have encountered. Whenever I take New Guineans to work with me in areas away from their own village, they are constantly picking up local plants, asking local people about the plants' uses, and selecting some of the plants to bring back with them and try growing at home. In that way, someone 1,200 years ago would have noticed the casuarina seedlings growing beside a stream, brought them home as yet another plant to try out, noticed the beneficial effects in a garden, and then some other people would have observed those garden casuarinas and tried the seedlings for themselves. Besides problems of wood supply and soil fertility, New Guinea Highlanders also faced a population problem as their numbers increased. That increase became checked by war, infanticide, use of forest plants for contraception and abortion, and sexual abstinence and natural lactational amenorrhea while a baby was being nursed. New Guinea societies thereby avoided the fates that many other societies suffered through deforestation and population growth. Today, New Guineans are facing a new population explosion because of the success of public health measures, introduction of new crops, and the end or decrease of intertribal warfare. New Guineans adapted in the past to the end of the ice ages, the development of agriculture, massive deforestation, volcanic fallouts, El Nino events, the arrival of the sweet potato, and the arrival of Europeans. Will they also be able to adapt to the changed conditions producing their current population explosion? Tikopia, a tiny, isolated tropical island in the southwest Pacific Ocean, is another success story of bottom-up management. With a total area of just 1.8 square miles, it supports 1,200 people. That's a dense population for a traditional society without modern agricultural techniques. Nevertheless, the island has been occupied continuously for almost 3,000 years. The nearest land of any sort is the even tinier island of Anuta, 85 miles distant, inhabited by only 170 people. The nearest larger islands, in the Vanuatu and Solomon archipelagos, are 140 miles distant, and still only 100 square miles each in area. In Tikopia's traditional small canoes, the open ocean voyage over the cyclone-prone southwest Pacific to any of those nearest neighbor islands was dangerous. The canoes' small sizes and the infrequency of the voyages severely limited the quantity of goods that could be imported, so that in practice, the only economically significant imports were stone for making tools, and unmarried young people from Anuta as marriage partners. Other imports consisted of luxury goods, shells for ornaments, bows and arrows, and pottery. There could be no question of importing staple foods in amounts sufficient to contribute meaningfully to Tikopian subsistence. In particular, Tikopians had to produce and store enough surplus food to be able to avoid starvation during the annual dry season of May and June, and after cyclones that at unpredictable intervals destroy gardens. Tikopia lies in the Pacific's main cyclone belt, with, on the average, 20 cyclones per decade. Hence, surviving on Tikopia required solving two problems for 3,000 years. How could a food supply sufficient for 1,200 people be produced reliably? And how could the population be prevented from increasing to a level that would be impossible to sustain? Our main source of information about the traditional Tikopian lifestyle comes from Raymond Firth's observations, one of the classic studies of anthropology. While Tikopia had been discovered by Europeans in 1606, its isolation ensured that European influence remained negligible until the 1800s. The first visit by missionaries did not take place until 1857, and the first conversions of islanders to Christianity did not begin until after 1900. Hence, Firth in 1928 had a better opportunity to observe a culture that still contained many of its traditional elements. Sustainability of food production is promoted by its high rainfall, moderate latitude, and location in the zone of high volcanic ash fallout and high fallout of Asian dust. Those factors constitute a geographical stroke of good luck for the Tikopians. The remainder of their good fortune must be credited to what they have done for themselves. Virtually the whole island is micromanaged for continuous and sustainable food production. Almost every plant species on Tikopia is used by people in one way or another. Even grass is used as a mulch in gardens, and wild trees are used as food sources in times of famine. As you approach Tikopia from the sea, the island appears to be covered with tall, multi-storied original rainforest. Only when you land and go among the trees do you realize that true rainforest is confined to a few patches on the steepest cliffs, and that the rest of the island is devoted to food production. Most of the island's area is covered with a multi-storied orchard, whose tallest trees are species producing edible nuts, or fruit, or other useful products, of which the most important are coconuts, breadfruit, and sago palms yielding a starchy pith. Smaller useful trees in the middle story include the betel nut palm with narcotic-containing nuts, the viapple, and the medium-sized memi tree, whose bark was used for cloth. The understory below these tree layers is, in effect, a garden for growing yams, bananas, and the giant swamp taro, of which Tikopians grow a genetic clone adapted to dry conditions. This whole multi-story orchard is unique in the Pacific in its structural mimicry of a rainforest, except that its plants are all edible. In addition to these extensive orchards, there are two other types of small areas that are open and treeless, but also used for food production. One is a small freshwater swamp, devoted to growing the usual moisture-adapted form of giant swamp taro. The other consists of fields devoted to short, fallow, labor-intensive, nearly continuous production of three root crops, taro, yams, and now the South American introduced crop, manioc, that has largely replaced native yams. These fields require almost constant labor input for weeding, plus mulching with grass and brushwood to prevent crop plants from drying out. The main food products of these orchards, swamps, and fields are starchy plant foods. For their protein, traditional Tikopians relied to a minor extent on ducks and fish obtained from the island's one brackish lake, and, to a major extent, on fish and shellfish from the sea. Sustainable exploitation of seafood resulted from taboos administered by chiefs, whose permission was required to catch or eat fish. The taboos, therefore, had the effect of preventing overfishing. Tikopians still had to fall back on two types of emergency food supply to get them over the annual dry season and the occasional cyclone. One type consisted of fermenting surplus breadfruit in pits to produce a starchy paste that can be stored for 2 or 3 years. The other type consisted of exploiting the small remaining stands of original rainforest to harvest fruits, nuts, and other edible plant parts that were not preferred foods but could save people from otherwise starving. Those are the ways in which Tikopians assure themselves of a sustainable food supply. The other prerequisite for sustainable occupation of Tikopia is a stable, non-increasing population. During Firth's visit, he counted the island's population to be 1,278 people. From 1929 to 1952, the population increased at 1.4% per year, which is a modest rate of increase. Suppose, however, that Tikopia's initial population growth rate was also only 1.4% per year, and that the initial settlement 3,000 years ago had been by a canoe holding 25 people. It would have reached its modern level of 1,278 people within 283 years after human arrival. How was Tikopia's population held constant after 283 years? Firth learned of six methods of population regulation still operating on the island in 1929, and a seventh that had operated in the past. Of traditional Tikopia's seven methods of population regulation, the simplest was contraception by coitus interruptus. Another method was abortion, induced by pressing on the belly or placing hot stones on the belly of a pregnant woman near term. Alternatively, infanticide was carried out by burying alive, smothering, or turning a newborn infant on its face. Younger sons of families poor in land remained celibate, and many among the resulting surplus of marriageable women also remained celibate, rather than enter into polygamous marriages. Celibacy in Tikopia means not having children and does not preclude having sex by coitus interruptus, and then resorting to abortion or infanticide if necessary. Still another method was suicide, of which there were seven known cases by hanging and 12 by swimming out to sea between 1929 and 1952. Much commoner than explicit suicide was virtual suicide, by setting out on dangerous overseas voyages. Such sea voyaging accounted for more than one-third of all deaths of young bachelors. The seventh method of population regulation was not operating during Firth's visits, but was reported to him by oral traditions. Sometime in the 1600s or early 1700s, Tikopia's former large saltwater bay became converted into the current brackish lake by the closing off of a sandbar across its mouth. That resulted in the death of the rich shellfish beds and a drastic decrease in fish populations, hence in starvation for the Ngaariki clan living on that part of Tikopia at that time. The clan reacted to acquire more land and coastline for itself by attacking and exterminating the Ngaarevenga clan. A generation or two later, the Ngaariki attacked the remaining Ngaafaea clan, who fled the island in canoes, thereby committing virtual suicide rather than await their deaths by murder on land. Most of these seven methods for keeping Tikopia's population constant have disappeared or declined under European influence during the 20th century. As a result, Tikopia's population grew from its 1929 level of 1,278 people to 1,753 people by 1952, when two destructive cyclones within the span of 13 months destroyed half of Tikopia's crops and caused widespread famine. The British Solomon Islands colonial government responded by sending food, and then dealt with the long-term problem by encouraging Tikopians to resettle onto less populated Solomon Islands. Today, Tikopia's chiefs limit the number who reside on their island to 1,115 people. How and when did Tikopia's remarkable sustainable economy arise? The island was first settled around 900 BC by Lapita people, ancestral to the modern Polynesians. Those first settlers made a heavy impact on the island's environment. Remains of charcoal at archaeological sites show they cleared forest by burning it. They feasted on breeding colonies of seabirds, landbirds, and fruit bats, and on fish, shellfish, and sea turtles. Within 1,000 years, the populations of five bird species were extirpated. Also, in that first millennium, archaeological middens reveal the virtual elimination of fruit bats, a threefold decrease in fish and bird bones, and a tenfold decrease in shellfish. Around 100 BC, the economy began to change. Over the next 1,000 years, charcoal accumulation ceased, and remains of native almonds appeared, indicating that Tikopians were abandoning slash-and-burn agriculture in favor of maintaining orchards with nut trees. To compensate for the drastic declines in birds and seafood, people shifted to intensive husbandry of pigs, which came to account for nearly half of all protein consumed. An abrupt change in economy and artifacts around AD 1200 marks the arrival of Polynesians from the east. It was Polynesians who brought with them the technique of fermenting and storing breadfruit in pits. A momentous decision taken consciously around 1600 was the killing of every pig on the island. to be replaced as protein sources by an increase in consumption of fish, shellfish, and turtles. According to Tikopian's accounts, their ancestors had made that decision because pigs raided and rooted up gardens, competed with humans for food, were an inefficient means to feed humans, it takes about 10 pounds of vegetables to produce 1 pound of pork, and had become a luxury food for the chiefs. The evolution of Tikopian subsistence is better described by the bottom-up metaphor than by the top-down metaphor. One can walk all the way around the coastline in under half a day, so that every Tikopian is familiar with the entire island. The population is small enough that every resident can also know all other residents individually. Tikopia's chiefs do serve as the overlords of clan lands and canoes, and they redistribute resources. By Polynesian standards, however, Tikopia is among the least stratified chiefdoms with the weakest chiefs. Chiefs and their families produce their own food and dig in their own gardens and orchards, as do commoners. Thus, that role of Tikopian chiefs represents much less top-down management than does the role of the leaders of the remaining society that we shall now discuss.